WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. For 2 weeks, the world has watched as Ukrainians poured into Kiev's streets to protest the awarding of the recent presidential election to Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych. But for days, Ukrainian TV had offered nary a glimpse of the so-called Orange Revolution. Most of Ukraine's major TV channels complied with government edicts on how to cover the news. And that meant ignoring the demonstrations in support of Viktor Yushchenko, the opposition candidate who alleged widespread vote rigging. After years of state censorship, the crippled election coverage drove a handful of TV journalists to quit.
Last week, the few became the many. Dozens walked off the job to join the protests, and hundreds signed a petition demanding the right to report what they saw. At one point, a sign language interpreter on the state-owned channel UT1 went off script and signed on live TV that she would no longer lie for the government. Finally, on Thursday, the media owners capitulated and broadcast images of the protests. Many reporters returned to work. Many, but not Fedir Sudurok, a reporter at the channel called One Plus One. In October, he and six of his colleagues were the very first to resign, but they haven't been welcomed back. He joins me now on the line from Kiev. Welcome to OTM.
Well, thank you.
So how is the news on One Plus One different than it was, say, before last week?
The main thing is that the people are getting fair and objective news. I think it's totally different.
Talk to me about the rest of Ukraine's media right now. There's a mutiny of sorts at UT1, the state-owned channel.
Yes, there is a mutiny, but there is still a strong system of censorship there because the chief editor and the editors there are still under control from the president's administration. They have been put there in order to censor journalists. Although they're not doing that openly right now, but they're trying and trying and trying.
Let's cast our minds back to the middle of October and the weeks leading up to the election and the week following the election. How were people getting information about what was going on in the streets?
There was a source. We have a so-called opposition TV channel. It's called the Fifth Channel. You can see that they are Yushchenko supporters, but at least they try to have the news from all sides. Before the elections on One Plus One and other channels, Yushchenko supporters were completely banned from television. Some people don't even know who Yushchenko is still, so you can understand the level of disinformation. The government campaign against its own people by turning them into zombies had a lot to do with what's happening right now. But at the same time, their attempts to zombify the population had the opposite effect. You can see it on Independence Square, where you can see like 900,000 people meeting every day to say what they want.
So the media was complicit initially in attempting to, as you say, zombify the public. But don't the media now deserve some credit for standing up against censorship?
Yes, I am pleased that the media is doing what it's doing right now, trying to paint a fair and objective picture. But you see, this is also an agreement by the owners who are just, you know, seeing where the wind is blowing. And they want to jump on the last car of the train because if they don't, they'll be left behind. And I think there's a very clear difference. The journalists are only doing what the ownership is doing and not the opposite. People are just afraid for their jobs. They make good money on television. The average monthly wage in Ukraine was $60. And you can make a couple of $1,000 a month on TV. That is the problem, money.
I must say, this is a much darker view than what we're getting over here. We thought this was a triumph of media courage.
I'm sorry.
And you're saying it's merely a change in orders from above. So then, do you think that this candor on the part of the Ukrainian media will stay? Or will it simply shift as the power shifts?
Well, I think that when new people come to power, there is a good chance that they will try to do the same, to impose censorship and so on. You see, Ukrainian television is so used to working under censorship that I don't think they'll see the difference between the censors. So the journalists should not relax for a second.
I'm going to make one last pitch for the courage of Ukrainian journalists by pointing out that it is not safe necessarily for journalists in Ukraine to report news unbecoming of the government even now. Earlier this week, a reporter was attacked on his way back from covering a pro-Yushchenko demonstration, supposedly by assailants who told him he should be writing articles supportive of Yanukovych. They still take a risk for writing the truth.
Yes, of course. I mean, they were taking a risk when they were lying, actually, because some Yushchenko supporter could have beat them up. So I don't see the difference, actually. I'm sorry for the grim picture I'm painting, but you see anchors who lied to the people every day for 2 years, and now they're telling the truth for 7 days, and they are considered heroes. I mean, come on. I don't think that's very fair to other people who have been working for years against this system, who have been beaten up, killed, and so on.
And people who have given up big, fat salaries, like yourself.
Sure, but, I mean, money's not everything, as they say. You should not consider this as me being angry at these people. I don't think it's fair towards the other six people who walked out. I have a job because I'm an interpreter. I can, you know, translate The Simpsons and so on. But the other six people, they do not have a job. They have children who they have to feed. And they are the real heroes. I think the anchor at UT1 who was fired, that is the hero. I think the woman who used sign language to tell the truth, that is the hero. But the people who are still working at certain channels, I don't consider them heroes. I consider them chameleons. You know, they change color according to the tree that they're sitting on.
Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Fedor Sidoruk is a former reporter on international affairs for the Ukrainian TV channel One Plus One.
Much of the power of the Ukrainian demonstrations has been rooted in how well they play for the camera. Hundreds of thousands of people taking to the streets in spontaneous outrage sends a compelling message. But how spontaneous were those rallies, really? For months now, Ukrainian activists have been carefully stage managing the spontaneity with the help of uprising consultants, veterans of the Serbian street protests that finally undid Slobodan Milosevic. They've spent the last few years exporting their expertise to popular uprisings in Belarus and Georgia, the seed money for which has come in part from the United States government, which spent $40 million to fund the Serbian revolt. Ivan Marovic was a founder of Otpor, the Serbian political student group, and he's been consulting in places like Ukraine ever since. Ivan, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
Tell me first how Otpor did it in Serbia, and then tell me how you've exported the creation of a whole brand of protest to these other countries.
Otpor was actually the fourth attempt that I was involved in, and the other three were pretty much big failures. As a student activist and organizer, I was trying with my colleagues to find a way how to reach broader audience. Our inspiration came from multinational companies and things like Coca-Cola and or Levi's. What we needed was a simple message. What we needed was a simple logo so people could recognize it after 1 second. So that's why we picked a name Otpor, which means resistance. And also we picked a clenched fist. Our slogan was Gotovye, which means he's finished. And that was the most simple way to tell to the people that if they vote against Milosevic, he will be finished. It showed the good way of attracting one portion of the society which doesn't respond to classical political messages. And this is exactly what we were trying to pass to our friends and colleagues in Georgia and Ukraine, which is some sort of a package. But also the content of that package has to be carefully developed because a package cannot do the job for itself.
Well, there are striking similarities between the Ukrainian disputed election and the one in Belgrade that marked the beginning of the end for Milosevic, but obviously the details were very different, and the sloganeering was different as well. What logo and slogan was embraced by your colleagues in Ukraine?
What they did is that they made the slogan Pora, which means it's high time, and their logo is actually the ticking clock, which symbolically means that the clock is ticking for Kuchma and for his regime and the oligarchs that are controlling Ukraine at the moment. And that is different from Otpor's clenched fist, which was more a result of 10 years of civil war and economic sanctions and totally different situation.
I want to ask you about the potential downside of the underlying reality that the populace is being manipulated by the pro-democracy forces in approximately the same way it had been for decades manipulated by the sitting government. Is there no chance for backlash when the people realize that they have been, toyed with?
This is not a manipulation. You can fool some people for some time, but they are in the street for 10 days now. And they don't seem fooled. They seem that they're fighting for what they want. And what they want to fight for is their right to vote.
Now, the United States has a long and often very sorry history of interfering in the affairs of sovereign governments. Is there no risk that you will be perceived as an agent of Washington wherever you consult?
I wouldn't think that branding or training that I and my colleagues did were the most important. We maybe helped them like maybe 1%, maybe foreign funding helped them 5%, but 95% or 99% was thanks to their effort and their readiness to fight for their cause. It's up to them to seek funding. The only thing that we need to know before we start trainings is whether the groups we are working with are fighting for democracy, human rights, and better society in their countries, and that they use nonviolent methods.
I think it's easy to dismiss branding as just the very essence of superficiality in the, you know, the commercial culture and so forth. But one thing we learn here is that brands are not nothing, that they are actually the convergence of recognition and meaning, no?
Yes. In the 20th century, branding was done by connecting a movement to the leader. So everybody remembers Lech Walesa or Nelson Mandela or Mahatma Gandhi. In Serbia, Georgia, and Ukraine, branding was done not connecting to leaders. Leaders could have been blackmailed or bribed or even maybe killed. You can't do that with brands or ideas.
So where next? Uzbekistan comes to mind, Zimbabwe. Is your phone ringing off the hook with pleas for help from around the world?
It does ring every now and then. And if they are asking for help, we're willing to help and to share our experience with them.
At the moment, you're in the United States creating a video game for the next generation of activists. Tell me about it.
This game, I think the working title is A Force More Powerful, is a game where a player will be able to organize a mass movement against dictatorship. It's going to be a violent game with prosecutions, with arrests, with kidnapping. The only person that will not be allowed to be violent is the player.
Well, Ivan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ivan Marovic is a trainer for the Center for Nonviolent Resistance in Belgrade. He spoke to us from Washington.
Coming up, how America talks, or doesn't, in perilous times, and a peek at the record of our upcoming Attorney General.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with a correction. Our piece about fictional and real spies a few weeks back mistakenly assigned convicted traitor Robert Hansen to the CIA. Actually, he worked for the FBI. And now a couple of updates. A federal judge this week dismissed the libel lawsuit scientist Stephen Hatfill brought against the New York Times and its columnist Nick Kristof. Hatfill, who was named a person of interest in the FBI's investigation of deadly anthrax attacks in 2001, was the subject of several of Kristof's columns. Those columns charged the FBI with shoddy work, citing the increasingly persuasive circumstantial case against a mysterious Mr. Z, who many knew to be Hatfill. In 2002, we asked Kristof why he wrote those columns.
It was to light a fire under the FBI. I think the FBI did a catastrophic job for months and months and months. I think they weren't prepared to deal with a high-tech scientific investigation like this. It took them months to catch up.
Despite Hatfill's claims that the columns damaged his life and reputation, U.S. District Judge Claude Hilton ruled that Kristof's columns did not defame Hatfill and that they accurately reflected the state of the FBI's investigation, in which he was labeled a person of interest by Attorney General John Ashcroft. The judge's ruling has no effect on a libel suit Hatfill has filed against Ashcroft and other government officials that claims he was named as a person of interest to deflect attention from their failure to find the real anthrax killer. As yet, no one has been charged in that case.
Our second update concerns the conviction of Jim Tarakany, a reporter for WJAR, an NBC affiliate in Providence, Rhode Island. Tarakany is to be sentenced next week for criminal contempt for refusing to identify the source of a tape of Providence officials taking bribes. This week, his source, a lawyer who worked for one of the convicted officials, came forward after learning he was about to be subpoenaed. He said he had never demanded that the reporter keep his identity secret. Tarakany, who had a heart transplant in 1996, says he would never have risked his health and reputation if that were true. Meanwhile, it's still unclear whether the disclosure of his source this week will affect his sentence, which could be 6 months in jail. The lawyer came forward too late. The prosecutor says Tarakany's refusal to give up his source is still a crime.
Recently, on the media bid a less than fond farewell to Attorney General John Ashcroft. With the ink on his resignation letter not even dry, leading Democrats have already indicated that Alberto R. Gonzalez, the man nominated to replace Ashcroft, would not meet with resistance during Senate confirmation hearings. And so this week we thought we would look ahead. While we can't know for sure whether the Justice Department will be First Amendment friendly over the next 4 years, we can cross our fingers and make some educated predictions with the help of Lucy Dalglish, who is Executive Director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. Lucy, welcome back.
Thank you, Bob.
Your staff has prepared a report examining the likely impact of future Attorney General Gonzalez on both freedom of the press and the public's right to know. Based on what you know, would you characterize him as media friendly?
He has been the architect of several fairly substantial secrecy initiatives within the White House. And I would not anticipate him being friendly when it comes to access to information that could possibly be coming out of the executive branch agencies.
Well, let's first define executive privilege. As I understand it, it is the principle that allows the president to conduct policy formulation and work with his staff and negotiate with Congress or whatever else the president does without fear that the particulars of those discussions will be disclosed. Otherwise, he would be almost paralyzed from acting in his executive's role. But you're saying that this White House broadly expands the definition.
Yes. I think they believe that over the last 30 years, the executive branch gave away a lot of privileges, and I think they're trying to reclaim them. And Mr. Gonzalez was very instrumental in helping craft this policy, or if it wasn't his idea, at least he was the one who figured out how to pull it off.
You go on to say that as White House counsel, Gonzalez chose one battle to doggedly fight.
Well, when Bush and Cheney came into office, they were going to come up with a new energy policy, and I guess that's an issue that was delegated to Vice President Cheney, who, as you know, has a broad background in energy and oil from his days at Halliburton. There are a number of nonprofit groups out there, mostly Judicial Watch and some environmental groups, who were fairly convinced that this was not just internal deliberations or one-on-one meetings, but they thought that Vice President Cheney was inviting some big oil experts to come in and help come up with energy policy. And they wanted to know who these people were and what type of advice they were giving. The vice president said, no, that's an executive privilege issue, and we don't have to release it. So those groups sued, and it's still being fought in the courts, because this is an administration that has an intrinsic belief in executive secrecy.
Well, this brings us right back to Alberto Gonzalez, who at one point submitted an affidavit that extended executive privileges, in the words of your report, Lucy, to, quote, government papers the president has never seen and officials he has never talked to, which would mean, I guess, that anybody working for the executive branch who does anything right or wrong can shield himself behind this, you know, invulnerable force field of
executive privilege. Yes. In 1978, they passed a law that said, beginning with the president elected in 1980, 12 years after that president leaves office, his papers will be released to the public. And of course, the first president and vice president that applied to was Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. And the first president who had to deal with that law was George W. Bush. So the Reagan papers were supposed to become public on January 20th, 2001, and led by Alberto Gonzalez, the Bush administration delayed it. Then they delayed it again. They sent out an executive order and they said, you know, okay, we'll release it, but any president who is still alive or his family or the sitting president can designate records to not be released.
Maybe more disturbing still is that Gonzalez's penchant for secrecy and broad definition of executive privilege is hardly limited to domestic energy policy or any domestic policy. He infamously referred to the provisions of the Geneva Conventions as quaint.
Quaint.
And he recommended against releasing information about the treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo. Does he at least make a good case for secrecy in this matter?
Obviously, in times like this, there needs to be some secrecy. I'm one of the people who believes that we as a society are better off if we know who we've charged with a crime and what we're doing to those people.
Lucy, thank you so much, as always.
You're welcome.
Lucy Dalglish is executive director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, and unfortunately, is a very busy woman.
What does George W. Bush have in common with John Adams, Abraham Lincoln, Woodrow Wilson, FDR, Harry Truman, Johnson, and Nixon? As commanders of American wars, they each took measures to quell dissent at home, and all of them, according to Jeffrey R. Stone's new book, Perilous Times, went too far. Jeffrey Stone is here to talk with us about what happens to this show's favorite constitutional amendment when the nation is at war. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Delighted to be here. Thanks.
So your book is organized around the six moments in American history when the government has regulated political speech. They were all during periods of war or quasi-war. Can you give us a quick rundown?
Sure. The first was when the United States was on the verge of war with France. 1798, the Federalists made it a crime for any person to criticize the government, the Congress, or the president. During the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus, which resulted in the detention of many individuals for their dissent. During World War I, Woodrow Wilson enacted legislation that made it a crime to criticize the war or the draft. During World War II, although the primary civil liberties issues was the internment of Japanese Americans, the Roosevelt administration also attempted to denaturalize and deport individuals who were deemed American fascists. During the Cold War, the United States slipped into a frenzy in which tens of thousands of Americans were humiliated, were exposed, were fired, were blacklisted, and were prosecuted for their political beliefs. And during the Vietnam War, the Nixon administration engaged in widespread surveillance of political anti-war organizations and attempted to intimidate and harass those organizations.
Let's go back to 1798. And the first person ever to have been jailed under the Sedition Act was a man named Matthew Lyon.
Right. Lyon was a congressman from Vermont. He was a frontiersman, a very much self-made man. He was opposed to the Federalists, who tended to be much more upper crust than the Republicans of Jefferson and Madison. And Lyon was eventually prosecuted for giving a speech in which he accused the Adams administration of being concerned primarily with its own pomp and its own ridiculous self-importance. And for that, he was sentenced to prison.
Basically, his crime is that he had a big mouth, but no lack of patriotism.
Oh, exactly right. Many of the characters in this book were individuals who had deeply felt and passionate political views that were not within the mainstream, views that in many instances eventually came to be accepted. And we're very much in debt for their persistence, their stubbornness, and their insistence on continuing to express their views, even over the efforts of the government to suppress them.
Now, the most cinematic character in your book is probably Molly Steimer, who wasn't allowed to stay anywhere very long by dint of the fact that she couldn't keep her mouth shut.
Yeah, she was my favorite character in all of this 200 years of history. Steimer arrived in the United States as an immigrant from Russia. Immediately upon arriving, she found work in a factory. She began reading and was curious and became, over time, a trade unionist and eventually an admirer of Emma Goldman and Bakunin. During World War I, she opposed the United States' participation in the war. She was arrested and prosecuted for essentially encouraging opposition to the war. Finally, in the early 1920s, the government decided to deport her to the Soviet Union. And at that time, there was a railroad strike, and Molly Steimer refused to leave her prison cell because she refused to ride on a train, which was being operated by scabs. After the strike finally ended, she was sent to the Soviet Union. The Russian Revolution had evolved in ways that she was not happy about, and she became a vehement protester against the Soviet government. After several years, she was deported then from the Soviet Union to Germany, being, so far as I know, the only person in history ever to be deported both from the United States and from the Soviet Union. She was a quite remarkable person. I mean, Molly Steimer was 4'9" tall. She weighed about 90 pounds, and she was as determined and fierce and deeply committed to her principles as anyone in American history.
Now, of the six eras of unfree speech that you talk about in your book, you pick out three as the most egregious. What were they?
Well, the period of the Sedition Act of 1798, World War I, and the Cold War were by far the most egregious. And what made them so extreme is that in each of those instances, politicians and or government officials went out of their way to exploit and to use opportunistically the natural fear and anxiety that is produced in any wartime situation. So in 1798, the Federalists attempted to take advantage of the impending war with France to enact legislation that would enable them to try to put the Republican Party of Jefferson and Madison entirely out of business by prosecuting anyone who was critical of the Adams administration.
Now, in the other two cases, basically you say the same pernicious forces at work, that the principal aim of suppressing free speech wasn't necessarily to increase the security of the country, but simply to repress a voice that would question the people in power. In other words, partisan voices.
Exactly right. So during the Cold War, for instance, Republicans like Joseph McCarthy and Richard Nixon saw the opportunity to use the Red Card as a way to rally Americans to take advantage of their fear, to exacerbate their fear, and therefore to essentially say that you cannot trust the Democrats are not adequately protecting us against the Red Menace, only Republicans can do that for you. During World War I, President Wilson led the United States into a war where we had not been attacked, and he therefore faced the problem of both creating an outraged public that would be willing to make the sacrifices that war demands, and also attempting to turn people against those who would be dissenting, because there were many individuals who opposed our entry into the war because, in fact, we hadn't been attacked.
Where do you think the Bush administration stacks up during the War on Terror to these other epochs?
Well, certainly the Bush administration has reacted to post-9/11 circumstances in ways that are similar to those that existed in the past. One of the primary ways that the Bush administration has attempted to shape public discourse is by controlling information and by a kind of obsessive secrecy. You control public debate by simply denying individuals access to critical information. But if one talks about the magnitude of repression, the truth is there is no real comparison. For many periods in our history, it was, in fact, a crime for an individual to attack the government or the conduct of a war. Certainly the speeches of people like Howard Dean and John Kerry in 2004 would have been criminal during World War I, during the Civil War in 1798, and yet that would be totally unthinkable today. But it's also the case that it's important to recognize that we have overreacted, and those overreactions matter.
As you've noted in your book, 80% of American history has not occurred in wartime, and during that 80%, people have not been jailed for expressing themselves politically. But now we are in a time, which our president has said we may not see the end of for a very long time, of permanent, amorphous war against terror. What are we to make of a time of war without end?
It's an especially dangerous one if we truly believe that it is a war without end. One consolation one can take from these historical periods is that each of them was relatively short-lived, and that once they ended, the nation saw again that it had behaved badly and, in a sense, strengthened its commitment to civil liberties. But in a situation in which one believes that this is a permanent war on terrorism, as I happen not to believe, but if one believes that, then one should be even more cautious about making these sorts of compromises because there won't be a light at the end of the tunnel.
Jeffrey Stone, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Jeffrey Stone is the Harry Calvin Jr. Distinguished Service Professor of Law at the University of Chicago and author of Perilous Times.
We had a lot of reaction to last week's show, which featured some musically themed segments. John Dye of Milwaukee wrote in to say, "I cannot believe how insensitive you are. Immediately after exposing earworms for the pests they are, you and your staff aired Tag You're It. After playing this snappy song once, you played it again, this time sung by country legend Willie Nelson. While you seem to understand the full effects of earworms, you did not mind leaving this song in my head to play over and over again. The worst part, to alleviate earworms, I will purchase the trapped song and play it again and again until my mind loses interest. However, with Tag You're It, there is no way to buy or download this song. Were you conducting some sort of experiment? Do you enjoy my pain? Lament no more, John. You can now find a free MP3 of the song at onthemedia.org. From the less ironic and playful side, disappointed fan and WBUR listener Joanne Barkin wrote in to say, "I had started to think that OTM was the best show on public radio, and then you aired a true dud. Driven to Download was a rehash of that old story about major labels barring the way for new music talent. Earworms was not the first story I've heard about songs that lodge themselves in your mind, but it was less amusing than the others. Nashville Bob, about Bob Garfield's effort to write a country western song, was the low point. It was a complete waste of airtime." Clearly, it's not a waste of time for you to write into us. Keep it coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org, remembering always to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Up next, the Pentagon calls up CNN to broadcast a lie, and for the wee ones, songs to hate by.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In last Tuesday's Los Angeles Times, Mark Mazzetti reported that a Marine spokesman appeared on CNN to announce that troops were, quote, crossing the line of departure, which is military jargon signaling the start of a major campaign, fully 3 weeks before the Fallujah offensive began. Mazzetti reported that the Marines' carefully worded announcement was an elaborate psychological operation, or PSYOP, intended to dupe the insurgents and allow U.S. commanders to see how guerrillas would react if they believed U.S. troops were entering Fallujah. Of course, they also duped the U.S. media, who are charged with truthfully informing the American people. The Pentagon says it's looking into the incident. On this program, we've examined the risks of what analyst Bill Arkin called PSYOP blowback. He's back to follow up. Bill, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
In the past, we've discussed propaganda as a means for winning hearts and minds, but this was calculated strictly for military purposes, for the commanders on the battlefield. Was it an effective tactic on those grounds?
The deception here is self-deception, deception on the part of those Marines who thought that Zarqawi was going to be watching CNN and base his actions on that. Zarqawi is there on the ground, just like the Marines are, and he and the insurgents are making their moves based upon their tactical read on the ground. What's unfortunate here is that somebody who probably had a good idea, let's create some sort of stimuli in which we force the insurgents to make the first move, thought then that somehow the Iraqis in Fallujah were sitting there watching CNN, and that that was the vehicle by which to practice this deception. And that shows a degree of ignorance on the part of the American military and an ignorance of the Iraqi mindset that I think is more worrisome than the efforts at strategic deception.
Okay, we'll talk about tactics and ignorance in a moment, but you mentioned good idea. Was it really a good idea? What about the obvious damage that this kind of trick does to the Pentagon's credibility with the press and with the American people? A liar is a liar. Why should Americans ever believe a single word from the Defense Department from this point forward, including and the?
My guess is that the reason why the Pentagon admitted and apologized for the use of CNN was that they themselves recognized that using the American media is not the best way to go about their psychological operations campaign. The danger for the American people, I think, is that they may get a distorted view of the success of our campaigns or a distorted view of what's going on tactically, which then I think influences how they consent to the use of force and their support for American military operations overseas. But I think the real danger for the credibility of the United States, that is an assumption on the part of those outside of this country that the U.S. government lies and that it does so without any compunction, is part of the broader problem of our losing hearts and minds.
Let's assume there was the germ of a good idea here. Are you suggesting that had this military spokesman appeared on Al Jazeera or Al Arabiya, that the tactic might have worked better?
If there were some effort going on at the CIA or in the White House that was trying to influence the way Al Jazeera reported the news because there was a belief that it would have some long-term impact on the way in which the Arab world viewed the United States, I say more power to them. But the reality is that we shouldn't confuse the tactical on the ground with the strategic. And in this particular case, I don't see any use even for Al Jazeera in the Fallujah campaign. There are things that are done by the military on the ground tactically that can deceive the enemy in terms of what its activities are. False communications, false moves, false starts, etc. And those are things that the other side can detect and react to. None of them, not in the history of warfare, has necessarily included the use of the news media to affect that tactical outcome.
Bill, tell me about Charles Krohn, the former CPA spokesman, and his view of the success of the Hearts and Minds operation. You think there's something very telling in his remarks?
Well, Krohn and others have lamented the incompetence of the American government in pursuing its campaign to win hearts and minds. Their focus has been if we had only done it better. And an example that Krohn uses, for instance, in a recent article was that when the United States came into Baghdad, it spent its time and energy building an Arab language television station, but it was a UHF, VHF station. It was a rabbit ears station. And everybody was running to get satellite dishes so that they could be on Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya. They weren't watching rabbit ears television and didn't care less. And he said it took 6 months before the United States got a satellite television capability up and running. And the suggestion here is that, boy, if we had just had satellite TV up and running from day one, you know, we would have done so much better. And it's a typical Washington kind of answer. And the reason why people watch Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya is not that they don't have an alternative. It's that it is media which projects and amplifies their own views about the world and their own views about the American occupation, about the nature of the United States, etc. Unless the United States policies in the real world reflect a different way of operating. The reality is that the only impact is going to be that we're going to be deceiving ourselves.
All right. Well, Bill, thanks very much.
Thank you.
William Arkin is a military analyst for NBC. And he joined us from his home in snowy Vermont.
Fall, Panzerfaust Records embarked on a venture called Project Schoolyard. It's basically a distribution effort for hate music. Based in St. Paul, Minnesota, Panzerfaust is, according to Newsweek magazine, one of the top white power record labels in the country. Through methods as simple as direct mail and handing out CDs to kids filing off the school bus, Project Schoolyard aims to hand out 100,000 CDs to kids who may not even realize what they're being handed.
or what they are listening to once they pop it in. The CD, called Sampler Volume 1, purposely contains some of the more tame material that the label offers. This way, the kids will be drawn in by the guitar licks and the beat without necessarily hearing what the lyrics are actually saying. The goal? Well, the website says, quote, "We don't just entertain racist kids, we make them." Alana Stern from the Anti-Defamation League says,
"This is the first step in trying to attract young people. And then obviously if kids take the bait, it'll get deeper and deeper and more hardcore. This is a recruitment tool, but a very well-organized recruitment tool."
According to the Panzerfaust website, Project Schoolyard originated in Germany, where it met with an all-out effort by government officials to stop it dead. According to the website, police contacted every single school in Germany, warning them to look out for volunteers passing out the CDs. In the end, Project Schoolyard Germany was basically a failure, but then it hopped the pond, and here, its freedom of expression is protected by the First Amendment.
Minnesota Public Radio reporter Jeff Horwich profiled Panzerfaust Records last spring, before Project Schoolyard hit the heartland this fall.
White power music doesn't have its own award show or an aisle in most record stores, but it's out there. Bands like Brutal Attack, Whitewash, and Rebel Hell. Some songs celebrate white racial pride, others glorify beating and killing minorities. Some call for a global war among the races. The industry does not publicize sales figures, but the nation's 50 or so white power music labels will sell hundreds of thousands of CDs this year. St. Paul's Panzerfaust Records is one of the biggest of those labels, the very biggest, according to the company itself. The label is named after a Nazi anti-tank weapon. It arose in 1997 from an active Twin Cities skinhead music scene centered around one nationally prominent band called Bound for Glory. As it grew, Panzerfaust literally helped put Minnesota on the map, the map of national hate groups put out by the Southern Poverty Law Center. The two men who run Panzerfaust make the center's list of 40 figures who are the future of what it calls the radical right, a category that spans neo-Nazis, Klansmen, and Confederate pride groups. One of those two men is Byron Calvert, who agreed to meet in a St. Paul park while his wife watched their three kids on the playground. Calvert has been in and out of Minnesota since falling in with the skinhead scene here 16 years ago. Last year, he left Panzerfaust's major competitor, Resistance Records. Calvert has a history as vivid as the tattoos and scars over his massive upper body, but that image belies what even his enemies say is a genuine talent for business.
Panzerfaust is kind of known more as a skinhead label as far as it's run by skinheads, and it runs from country to folk to rock and roll to just traditional British working class type music. We've got everything from the really hardcore, blatantly openly racist white power type of music. You've got a lot of stuff that's more subtle. These days, the people that are moving into our circles are so musically talented, and there's literally thousands of pro-white, what would be considered loosely pro-white or white power bands on the planet. You know, there's Czech bands, there's Italian bands, you've got Valkyria, and you've got Saga, who are female Swedish folk tunes.
Panzerfaust sells a multitude of different musical genres. That's part of the strategy.
This is Devin Burkhart. He runs Turn It Down, an educational and marketing campaign against white power music.
The strategy is to reach into different youth music subcultures and try to find a base. That's why they have such a wide variety of acts and artists, so they can appeal to a larger group. Listening to this stuff 10, 15 years ago, there's been a pretty marked change, actually, in terms of the quality of production, musicianship, and in terms of the variety in which they market it. So, you know, they're definitely learning the craft. Now it can't be easily dismissed as just crappy punk rock.
Panzerfaust always had good customer relations. We turn around and we send orders out the next day. They've always given away tons of free goodies to kids. If there was ever a question with an order, you know, we'd resend it and that kind of stuff. But, you know, I like to go to the library and read books on marketing and stickers and literature. You know, we just jam as much stuff into a package as we can. Those kids, they know who in their school or which one of their relatives or, you know, their coworkers or whatever, and they actually, you know, spread the word for us. It is growing. We've got thousands of customers in over 40 different countries, but as far as what we do on a daily basis, we don't really get into that. But I will say that it's over the last couple of years, it's probably doubled.
White Power Music has not only become the single number one recruiting tool bringing people into the movement, it's also become a multi-million dollar a year international enterprise. Panzerfaust in particular spends most of their time funneling the money back into the movement to fund concerts and events and literature.
We're probably the only genre of music that I've heard of that really couldn't give a damn. If somebody came along and wanted to bootleg or do free downloads of a million of our songs, it would just save us the time and trouble and hassle, you know? I mean, it's going to get the music to more kids.
Many of the folks who helped found Panzerfaust were at one time or continue to be members of the Hammerskin Nation, which is a violent confederation of neo-Nazi skinheads around the country. They have a whole string of murders, assaults, and other crimes going back to the 1980s.
When you hear people say, well, but my gosh, you guys are associated with violence, that's just nuts. I can tell you for a fact that I have never once in my life attacked anybody because of their race. I've never done it. Obviously, we don't suggest to kids that they listen to the CD and go out and do the stuff that's on the CD any more than the people that produced Grand Theft Auto 3 are sued or held responsible for the rate of car thefts in the cities in America. You know, it's entertainment. My kid's 4 years old, he watches Three Stooges, and he hadn't yet poked out his brother's eye, you know what I mean?
Musicians ready for violence, let's hear a loud ah! To all those who support us, time bombs are ticking in the room that we practice. The pigs will pay with every last of our blood.
You know, we're talking about lyrics, which include things like, calls for violence against African Americans, gays and lesbians, Jewish folks and others, in explicitly racist and anti-Semitic terms. And it is some of the harshest, most vile language you can imagine.
The rap industry is a multi-billion dollar industry where they sing expressly about hurting white people. And I don't see anybody calling them to question, making them justify, you know, why.
We certainly agree that they've got a free speech right to sing whatever they want to sing. We think it's also, therefore, important that those of us who are concerned about it, and there are many, use our First Amendment obligation to speak out against it.
Land in turmoil, timbers, I'm starting to boil. There's no chance of calling the Jews. Oh, hell, it's going like loose.
Eminem and Kid Rock are not the only working-class white kids whose experience is a story that needs to be told. You know, there's a lot of other kids. Our customers here in Minnesota, if you saw them, you probably wouldn't know it. I mean, it's high school kids. It's girls in the suburb. I probably do over 100 emails a day, and it's just nuts how many emails I get that are your average 14- or 15-year-old kid that came across as by doing an internet search or because he saw a sticker or some friends of his told him about the label. And they go and they actually read the literature, they read the articles, they listen to the MP3s, they watch the videos, they see what it is we're saying. And it's like they just soak it up.
Jeff Horwich produced that report for Minnesota Public Radio.
Oh,
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Ann Kosseff. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And Women's E-News, news every day on issues of particular concern to women and with women's perspectives on public policy, at womensenews.org. Support for On the Media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR, National Public Radio.